So I'm going to talk in the beginning today about the overwintering strategy of the planet and their migration. Mostly I'm going to focus on the population east of the Rockies, which is the one that goes all the way to Mexico. I'm from the University of Minnesota, so that's the population that I know the most about. That's what's where I live. There aren't monarchs in Holden Village. There are some monarchs east in eastern Washington, and I have a map I'll show you. Those ones would not necessarily migrate to Mexico. They would go to California. And we'll talk about that. So, but mostly I'm going to focus on the one that goes to Mexico. So every fall, so all the monarchs in the Rockies, which are by the end of the summer mostly concentrated north of Missouri and in the Northeast as well. But there's not too many monarchs left in the southern United States. It's just too hot for them in the summer, for them to stay kind of on that almost Gulf Coast state. So this is a picture taken of milkweed, which is their host plant. That's what all the caterpillars eat. This is a picture taken of milkweed in the fall in Minnesota. It doesn't look too appetizing. And so as soon as the milkweed starts to look like this, the monarchs know I know what it is. Okay? So that's what triggers them to leave. This is a picture of milkweed in the winter. This is exactly why the monarchs have to leave. They are a tropical butterfly. They evolved in Costa Rica, so they can't take any freezing at all. Most insects, most butterflies in whole climate will stay for the winter. And if everybody knows about the monarch and everybody knows about the monarch migration, so I think a lot of people kind of assume that most butterflies migrate, but it's actually the opposite. A lot of them stay in the winter. And they might overwinter as eggs, caterpillars, pupa, or adults. Every butterfly does something different. But all insects that live in a whole climate have kind of like this antifreeze in them. Same thing that we model antifreeze that we use after. And it's a chemical that makes it so that they don't freeze solid in the winter. That is quite bad. But monarchs, because they evolved in Costa Rica, they don't have that. So at the end of the last glaciation, as the glacier moved north, you think about what you know about the middle of the United States, all those prairies. And as the glaciers moved north, milkweed, which is what they eat, but then it moved north as well and moved into the prairies, what became the prairies of the middle of the country. So monarchs, using milkweed as their food source for their caterpillars, followed that milkweed. And that's how the migration evolved. Okay, so they definitely can't stay north in the winter, so they have to go south. We didn't find out where the monarchs went in the winter until the late 70s. Everybody knew that there were these beautiful butterflies and they were around all summer and they all congregated. People knew that they were going somewhere, but we never knew where they went. And in the 70s, a guy named Chip Taylor started this hanging program. And this is what the tank looked like kind of in the middle 80s. That's when the picture was taken. Now they're circular and even smaller. And they actually worked with 3M, which is a Minnesota company that makes all the stock tape, to develop a really strong system that would, so that we want to make sure that those tanks didn't fall off. So there's this huge change effort, still going on now, but in the 70s, where they put tags on all these butterflies, recorded the number of the tags, where they were released, and then if anybody found a butterfly with a tag on it, then you would then write that down, and you knew that that particular butterfly went from point A to point B. So eventually, they found this spot in Mexico where there were some butterflies that were tagged. So then they knew that that's where they were all going. Okay? And it's really hard to find. I have a picture of the older ones in a second, and then you'll kind of understand why it was so hard to find. So this is a map of North America, obviously, and these are the Rocky Mountains. So all the mountains east of the Rockies kind of funnel down through Texas, through the little pointy section. You got the Sierra Mountains here, so they can't really fly over a mountain. So they had a funnel through Texas here to the overwintering site in central Texas. Very mountainous there, and they're all low. So you've got all the habitat up here where the mountains are raised, and then they funnel down to that little part in Texas. And then any mountains west of the Rockies would shift down to California. And then there was a dotted arrow here. There was some speculation that some butterfly could go in between the Sierra Madres here and sneak down into Mexico. But we don't really know a whole lot about that, how many butterflies do that, and how that works. A couple of things that are important. Oh.
Come back.
No. So a couple of things that are important about the fall migration. When they're migrating, they're in what's called diapause. And what that means is that they're not reproductive. They're not mating, they're not laying eggs. And all that energy that they would be using to mate and lay eggs and search for mates, they're using just to fly. So that's a lot of energy that they save. And that also allows them to live all winter long. So butterflies in the summer typically only live for a month. And they're busy using all that energy to find mates, mate, and lay eggs. And so by not using their energy right away to reproduce, they're able to make it all the way down to Mexico and live all winter long. The migration typically happens starting up in the north in Minnesota and northern Canada in late August. So the butterflies that are the caterpillars that are being raised in late August in like Minnesota are taking in cues from the environment. They're noticing that the milkweed they're eating is not as high quality than that picture I showed in the beginning. They're noticing that it's getting a little bit cooler at night, that the amount of light is shortening. All those cues they're taking in as larvae and caterpillars to know that then when they're adults, when they're butterflies, that they're not going to mate. Okay? So it starts in late August and it takes them until early November before they reach the overwintering site. And that whole time while they're flying, they're just nectaring, getting as much energy as possible for the winter. There's not a whole lot of nectaring in the overwintering site. There's some, but not a lot. And it kind of acts like a wave. So the ones up here would probably leave in late August. And as they move down, they kind of pick up the other butterflies as they go. So by the time they get to Texas, it's a huge congregation. Okay? But and we notice that some in Minnesota, if you look up, you can tell there are more butterflies flying in one direction, but it's not quite as impressive as when you get farther. So, they gain lipids are like fats that they're getting from the nectar during the trip. They only fly during the daytime. They only fly, and this is important in the overwintering site too, when it's over 13 degrees Celsius, which is about 40, 45 degrees Fahrenheit. Any lower than that, and they can't fly at all. And then wind and precipitation can help or hurt them, as you can imagine. If they're flying against the wind, it's going to take more effort for the wind to help them. Are there any questions about that?
I didn't know there were fats
in nectar. It's all the sugar that they're converting. Huh. That. Yeah.
That's why when you cook it, turns into fat.
So the big things that they need while they're migrating, they need nectar. So some things that we worry about are habitat loss. And there's a program now called Monarch Wind Station, and it's a program to promote butterfly garden, particularly in schools, and, but also in nature centers, stuff like that, along the migratory path, so that the butterflies have some place to stop and get here. But if you think about that map in the United States, that whole middle part is cornfield, corn and soybeans now. So they have a huge part of the country that they're traveling where there is substantially less nectar for them. And this is their only chance to get it. They need roosting and stock oversight. This is a picture of the monarchs. I don't know how you can see it, but they're all clustered around the tree limb. And this is what it looks like in the overwintering site as well, but they do that along the way too. And people report that that they come in the same tree in the same yard every year. That there is something about that little microclimate that they like. So they definitely need someone to go for the night. Because like I said, they can only fly if it's over 13 degrees Celsius. So once it's nighttime, if it's getting lower than that, they just can't fly. They're cold-blooded and it's just, you think of a snake has to sun itself on a rock before it can move. Same thing. If it's too cold, it just can't move. So they definitely need somewhere to stop at night. They need safe flight path track. So we have to worry about roads. Most of the deaths to monarchs when they're migrating happen by being hit by cars. Because you think about the wind currents on roads are usually really nice. A lot of times you see raptors flying along the road to create those same wind currents, and the monarchs do too. And so that's a big hazard for them. And then kind of those same ideas, the climatic conditions for flight, and make sure that that they're not reproducing and conserving all those backstones that they worked really hard for.
Is that the milkweed that they're on there?
No, that is the entrance.
Okay. So the milkweed, explain the milkweed.
The milkweed is what they eat when they're caterpillars.
Oh, okay, it's caterpillars.
And it does have flowers, and a lot of times you'll see the adult nectaring on the flowers, but
okay.
They only eat the milkweed as caterpillars, and they only eat nectar as adults. So, this is a picture I took in Texas, and I was there in the fall, and on a nice sunny day like this, pretty much if you look up, you can see them flying. And sometimes they're so high that you really need binoculars, that you can't even see them without it. But if you take a pair of binoculars and look up, chances are you'll see them migrating through.
And how long a period is that?
It really depends on the weather. I was there last fall, and we had a lot of days where the wind would come in from the southwest. So you think about when they're coming through Texas, that map, and then they kind of veer down towards the mountains, and it's definitely southwest direction, and the wind would come in from the southwest. So they just kind of start piling up, because they can't go any farther. So it's really neat when you're there at that time. I was in Texas last fall for 2 weeks, and when I got there, there were only a few monarchs, and you can just see them. They just keep coming and coming and coming, and they can't leave. And then the wind shifts, and they got a cold front from the north, and they all left in one day.
Wow.
So it really varies year to year. But if there's a north wind the whole time, they'll just keep moving through. So this is a picture, again in Texas, from a picture of them roosting overnight. So those are the main things that they're doing, is just flying, nectaring, and then roosting.
They remind me of bats. Do they always hang on the bottom of branches?
The clusters in the overwintering site, you'll see pictures. I mean, they're all over. On top of each other, they're all over. But they do tend to have a southwest orientation. Just for once, mostly. Mostly because they can't fly when it gets below a certain temperature, if it's close, they just have to get somewhere.
Right.
And they're not entirely picky.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where they are in Mexico, in these mountains. And all these trees are all fir trees. And that's what they're looking for. And these trees kind of create this really perfect microclimate for them. It's not too warm, not too cold. And outside of the trees, there is snow in this part of Mexico. It's 10,000 feet above. So it's very cold, very snowy, but in the trees kind of act like a blanket, and it makes sure that the snow can't get through, that it doesn't get below freezing in where the monarchs are. So they're definitely looking for this type of habitat. And this AO right about here, this state here in Mexico, called Michoacán, and they're heading towards the mountain right in here. Okay. But it's a very, very small area. This is a picture of where the colonies are, where the butterflies are. And the blue is all the historical facts. So you can see they're just these little areas where they go. And then the red are where they were in 2004. There's been a lot of logging.
What's the scale on that? Are we talking miles or hundreds of feet?
No, miles. Miles. But so you would have to drive. You definitely have to drive to get between these. But you can stay in one town and go to all these. So this is one. Yeah, that helps. There's a lot of logging. These kind of peachy colors are protected areas where you're not supposed to log, and then this is kind of a buffer zone where there's limited logging, but there's actually more logging going on since they created the protected areas than before. So it's not working too well, but that kind of shows you where, how they're laid out. And so the whole thing is mountainous, and the whole thing was once one tree. So they're definitely looking for really specific conditions, a specific side of the mountain, amount of trees, all that different stuff that plays into it. So what they're doing in the winter, there are some, if it's warm enough, they'll fly around and drink, mostly just water from streams. And so this is a picture of a real shallow stream with lots of rocks, and so the butterflies kind of land on the rocks and pick up the moisture that's on the rocks and in the stream. So if it's warm enough, they will fly around. There is some nectaring that goes on, but when I was there, I did not see a whole lot of flowers. So most of their food they need to get on the way down. Later on in the spring, more towards February, there is some mating. But mostly, we think that's males initiate the mating, and we think that it's males that are in poor health and they know they won't make it north. So they mate in the lower winter colony because they've got all the females there, it's easy to get them. So we think that most of the mating that goes on is only in the spring, and it's only males that won't be healthy enough to make it. And this is a picture of them mating. So the male will kind of pounce on top of the female, even in the air, and then drop down on the ground and then they mate. And there is some predation. Monarchs are toxic to vertebrates because of the milkweed that they eat. So in the summer when they're scattered all around North America, they don't really have a whole lot of predators because it would take a lot of work for a predator to find a monarch. Plus they're poisonous, so there's not a whole lot of benefit to a predator overcoming the poison. But in the overwintering site, when they're all clustered on trees like this, kind of easy picking. So it makes it much more worth it for a predator to figure out a way to deal with the poison to figure out how to get past it.
So are there a couple specific species of adapted?
Why, there are, Carl. There are these. You think I planted that, but I didn't. So there are two birds that we have, the black-headed grosbeak and the black-beaked oriole. And the oriole, and I have a picture of that, the oriole makes a slit in the abdomen here, and just eats out the inside of the abdomen, which is where all the fat and the good stuff is anyway, and the poison is stored in the exoskeleton. So they just skip that all together. And then the black-headed grosbeak just eats the whole abdomen. So they figured out a way to partition off the poison so they don't have to, so it doesn't affect them. And the mouse eats everything but the wings. Okay? So this is a picture of just find a monarch in the overwintering site. Like that, you know that the oriole got it, and you can see the split. This one was eaten by the grosbeak, because the whole abdomen is gone. And then the mice will leave little passions, little storm of butterfly, where everything is gone but the wings. And we don't really know a lot about how the grosbeak and the mouse deal with the poison. But they're doing it somehow, and mostly because it's such, there's so many monarchs, I mean millions and millions and millions, that it's such easy food, that it's worth the risk to the poison. So basically their main goal during the winter is stay alive. So there's risk of starvation if it's too warm. And they fly too much, they're going to use up all their energy that they've stored up from flying back in the spring. They have to worry about predation, and they do have to worry about freezing. Like I said, they're at 10,000 feet, and it's very cold there, and with all the logging that's going on, the trees are not as able to protect them anymore as they once were. And they have to maintain diaphragm, and that, remember that? Means that they're not moving up here. And if it's too warm, it could trick them into thinking that it's later in the spring than it really is. And they might start becoming moving up here. And then if they're using more and more energy. Remember I said in the summer they're only living for a month at a time, and that's mostly because they're using all that energy to reproduce. So if it's too warm in the winter and they start becoming reproductive too early, that shortens their lifespan, and they may not make it. So this is a picture, this was taken from a plane. I don't know how long you can see this orange.
Oh yeah.
That's those are the butterflies.
Wow.
So you can see it from the air. And then this whole part was logged. So you can see they're right up to where they log. So if it got cold, that wind and that cold would come right up in here. And we've also seen them moving up the mountain, so the trees that are down lower are obviously easier to get. So they're logging kind of those trees, but that's also more, it's also warmer and less volatile climatically. So those were the trees that the monarchs were in. They're being forced to move up the mountain.
Is there any protection against logging? Or it looks like they can light them.
There's not. I mean, they have, the Mexican government recognizes that this is a huge tourist opportunity. I mean, it's really amazing going there. If this was in America, we would use that. We would, you know, there would be tour buses going all the time. And they kind of have that, but it's really unorganized, really hard to figure it out. If you were in the public, just interested in going, the best way to go is to find an American that's been there and go with them. But it's really unorganized. So there is protection there in theory, but the people around this area are so poor. They really don't have any choice but to log. And so,
what they do is sell the wood then.
They use some of it for firewood for the winter, for building their homes, and then they do sell it to them.
Now, is there any reason why they're not in that lower area? It looks like a little strip.
In here?
Yeah, see where the green strip is and down below it. Is there any reason why they're not there?
Probably.
Theoretically, they could go.
Theoretically, they could, but there might be something else. It might be the trees are a little thinner. It would be, it's hard to tell how the slope really works.
Yeah.
But, if it kind of, if the aspect isn't quite right, the angle of the orientation of the hill isn't quite right, it would be anything. But they really, if you remember the map of where the colonies are, it's really a specific spot. And they're looking for just the perfect climate. So this is another picture of them roosting. So this is what they're doing all day, every day. It's just hanging in these trees. The less they fly, the less energy they use, and the more likely they are to make it north and the spring.
Is that really temperature dependent? Like the temperature is keeping them from flying, or they know they can't fly because they
can't? It's the temperature. Yeah. And if they can fly, they will. In the beginning, there was a picture that I took, and I was talking about how as the sun moves up the mountain, as soon as it hits them, they're flying. So there's not a whole lot of thinking going on. But in theory, historically, before any of it was logged, the sun wouldn't have been able to hit the trees that they were in. So they wouldn't have really had to worry about it. Okay? And this is just a picture, this is actually the California wintering site, and these are eucalyptus trees. So just to kind of give you a contrast, they still kind of the same behavior, but there are less of them, and they don't roost all day. It's a little bit warmer there in California. There's more flying, there's more mating and nectaring going on in California. So then, late February, early mid-March, they leave Mexico and start going north. But then there's a dotted arrow and it's possible that they could find their way up there. And all of that is really temperature dependent. That's why I was talking about when it is winter, one of the worries if it's too warm is that they'll think that it's spring and start migrating and start winter. So they're getting all their cues from temperature and light levels. So they migrate north, and they pretty much avoid the Appalachians. Like I said, it's really hard for them to fly over a mountain. There is a population in southern Florida that doesn't migrate, and they reproduce all winter long. But we think that it's not a self-sustaining population, that they get migrants that are coming through that travel down, and it's possible they can also skip over the Gulf of Mexico and end up in Florida. But they travel first into the southern U.S. in there, and they lay their eggs there on milkweed. And then that generation then of offspring. So the one that left the north went all the way down to Mexico, where they all winter, came up here, laid eggs, and then their offspring are the ones that make it up here. And then they have two or three generations, depending on the weather again, in the summer, that are stationary, and then they start laying eggs. That's all temperature dependent, really. So during the spring, they are reproductive then. And it ends up in that southern part, kind of early to mid-March, and kind of trickle in through April. That generation happened, and they reached the northern part of their range in late May, early June. It takes two generations to get to their breeding, their summer habitat, and the spring conditions in the south are really, really key for kind of the health of the population all summer, because all of those butterflies that overwinter, their offspring are the ones that are really going to pollinate the entire part of North America. And if the spring conditions in the south, when they have that first generation, if it's too hot or too rainy or any of those things, and they don't get a good generation, a good amount of butter coming out of the south, that's going to kind of compound the whole summer. So that's really important for them. And this is a picture of milkweed in the spring. And it's really hard to see, but there is a right there, and they really, they find it as soon as it's there. It's pretty amazing. And they actually end up preferring kind of that new growth all summer, too. So one of the things that is really interesting about the spring migration is that they really have some needs that are a combination of migrations and breeding, considering both at the same time. So it's really an interesting time in the modern life cycle or annual cycle. So they need both milkweed and nectar plants, good weather conditions, and a safe life path. Are there any questions about that? No.
What happens, you talked earlier about the farm fields and the corn, the soybeans and all that. What impact do larger concentrations of corn with less weeds and less milkweed, how does that affect everything?
Well, it definitely has an effect on the nectar, as we talked about when they're migrating. It also has milkweed is a weed. It's a native plant, but it is, when you think about, we talked a lot at Holden about fire and what fire does for the ecosystem here. And the prairie has fire as well. And milkweed is one of the early species that comes in after a fire, and it's really prolific, and it is a weed. It likes kind of disturbed areas. So farm fields are actually great in some ways, for a matter, especially in the breeding. There's a ton of milkweed in farm fields. But now there's this Roundup Ready corn and Roundup Ready soybean that you can spray Roundup on your field and it kills everything but your crop. Because the plants have a gene put in them, and bioengineered to be able to tolerate Roundup. But that is a big problem in the summer and in the migrating north, because all that farmland that used to be prairie really still had milkweed, and now it doesn't have those nectar plants or milkweed. But you can still find milkweed in, I mean, the irony is that cities and suburban sprawl is actually probably really good for mother, because if you start looking, you can find milkweed everywhere. Sides of highways, railroad ditches, right of ways, I mean, butterfly gardens are everywhere. Carl knows when I'm out in the summer raising, you know, 1,000 caterpillars in a time, we go out looking for milkweed, you can spot it on the side of the highway. So suburban sprawl is probably good for them.
Well, they go after any milkweed. We have, much in Southern Cal, we have a narrow leaf milkweed. There isn't much to eat off of that.
Yeah, is that the same stuff that we have in Minnesota called world milkweed? And when you, a lot of students have done choice studies, so they'll narrow the caterpillar in multiple different kinds of milkweed and see which one they like the best. And they actually end up liking that skinny leaf milkweed a lot better, but I don't see a whole lot of egg and caterpillar on it because it wouldn't probably be able to feed an entire caterpillar throughout cold.
I'm curious about what you know about their flight capacity. Like, how far would they go in a day?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's probably variable.
It's really, really variable based on the wind conditions.
But are they more dependent on sort of being blown along by weather conditions, or do they actually locomote themselves quite a bit?
They do. And they have to fly against the wind. But they, if they're not desperate, if it's not getting too late, they will deflate from what they overwing. But they do definitely fly themselves, but if they're not any wind, they definitely fly themselves. Which is why when they need so much nectar and why they're not reproducing, they are expending a lot of energy to get down there. But they'll obviously use the wind if they can. Yeah, and I want to say they can go 100 miles in a day, but I think it's so variable that it's not a really useful
statistic. Yeah.
So if there's no wind, what is their speed?
Their speed? I can't think of that off the top of my head. But it was definitely, it's interesting when you look at butterflies a lot, you really get used to the way that they fly. Some people think that you can set a butterfly based on their flight, and that the male in the summer when they're looking for mate, they'll fly in concentric circles. No, sorry. They'll fly in a straight path, but they're just looking for females, trucking along, just looking for females. But females will fly in concentric circles because they're looking for milkweed. Just kind of fanning out, looking. And so then the idea that the male would bisect there.
Is that how the male finds them, the way
they bisect? Some people claim that they can set the monarch based on their flight path.
Mm-hmm.
And that the male would fly straight and the female would fly concentric. And then obviously when they're migrating, they would all fly straight. And I was telling Barbara the other day, last fall, when I was in Texas, I brought butterflies that I raised in Minnesota in the fall, so they should have all been migratory and not reproductive. Brought them out in Texas, I had them in these big cages, 6 foot by 6 foot by 6 foot cages. And for the first 5 days, they were in that southwest corner, just pointed in the southwest direction. It was warm, it was nice, they weren't flying. They were just in that one corner of the cage, all lined up, waiting. So, any other questions?
So, are we starting to see changes in their patterns or life cycles with climate change, or is that another topic?
Well, yeah, I do want to get into that on Saturday.
Okay.
And that is what I'm most interested in. One of the things that I think it's really interesting, when I said they were migrating to Mexico, they're not reproducing. But we see eggs and caterpillars in Texas in the fall. So clearly somebody is reproducing and trying to figure out if there's something going on in Minnesota or in the north that is making them migratory but reproductive. Which is what they're doing in the spring. That second generation is going from the southern U.S. north, and they're laying eggs the whole time. So it is definitely a different migration than in the fall. And so trying to figure out, are they migrating and reproductive from the north, laying their eggs all the way down, or is there something in Texas that is making them reproductive? And that experiment I was talking about, when they were in the cages, there was milkweed in those cages. Some native, and then there was this milkweed from Mexico that very pretty, and it overwinters in Texas, and lots of people plant it in their gardens, and it's in parks, zoos, everywhere. And that milkweed is being watered and maintained all summer long. So all the native milkweed in the prairies in Texas has snapped its dry, sometimes you can't even find it. just completely gone. It's been too hot and too dry all summer. But then there are all really beautiful, healthy milkweed from Mexico in gardens that's been watered and maintained. So it's possible that they're migrating through, and then like, if there's that southwest wind and they're staying in one spot for a week, waiting to be able to migrate, and they're being exposed to those, that milkweed that whole time, if that's what's making them start reproducing again. Yeah.
I'm, again, on the flight issue, I'm just amazed that handling them and sticking a sticky on them doesn't hurt their capacity to fly.
And
they, how do you?
They must have tough. You can do a thing where you basically tie the butterfly to a string, and then you have a base, and you see, it's a way to see what direction they fly.
Uh-huh.
But then you use that same thing to see how well they fly, and it doesn't seem to have an effect on them at all.
We still have kids.
With nets and hold them still.
They do that. There is some, there's tons and tons of monitoring programs for at the water in the summer. There's 4th of July butterfly counts all over the country where people go out every 4th of July and just count every butterfly they see and obviously monitor. Usually one of them. There are health that go on in the fall as they're migrating through, particularly in places more southerly where you would get big congregations of them, don't have them. And so you could catch them when you're doing that and put the tank on. A lot of teachers and schools and classrooms do it where they'll raise monarchs in the fall as part of their science, and then they'll just tag them before. Because you can go online to Monarch Watch, that's the organization that does the tag, and you can go online and order as many tags as you want, and put them on as many butterflies as you want, as many monarchs. And so, but it doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah, because in the net, don't they get nervous catching them in the net and everything? And I have heard that if they flutter their wings too much, then they lose some of those.
They do. But I mean, there are ways to hold them that hurts them less. I mean, when you pull them out, if so they've got four wings, and you can hurt them. And when you touch them, you can see the scales come off on your hand. But to a certain extent, that's not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just one person putting one tag on, it's not really going to matter.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, if you think about if you're raising them in a classroom, they've had a really great head start of all the food they could ever blast, all that good stuff. So, but if you, when you hold them and there's instructions online, but you can kind of push all four, they're naturally kind of do that. And if you push all four wings together and hold them like that, they really can't struggle a whole lot and stuff like that. And they teach them when they tag to put them kind of as close to the base in the way as possible, which would help with the balance and center of gravity.
So then if you tag it, you have to go online and log where you tagged it?
So all the tags have individual numbers, and you put where you are and when you tagged it. And then there are people in Mexico, they actually pay them to, for every tag they bring back. What size things so, there are people in Mexico that then just spend all day in the winter colonies looking.
But do you have to, it's glued on, so do they record the number?
They can just record the number. There's a lot of dead butterflies on the floor, too. And the clutchmen are actually pretty high up, so most of them are found below.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in Mexico, we were doing a parasite study. So we were taking huge butterfly nets, and that, so we would go really early in the morning, 5:30 or 6, when it was still in the clusters, so then they were really easy. Yeah, and we had a huge butterfly net, and we would just put a big hole in them, and we put them up around the cluster carefully. And the butterfly, if you hold the butterfly, can't fly away. Put the net around the cluster, and then you shake, and they all just fall in, and you can get 400 at a time. And they just fall into the net, and then we test them for the parasite that we're interested in them, and run go. But, I mean, it would be fairly easy to do the same thing with the tag. And we came across, I think, 2 tags in a whole week. Yeah. Well, that's the other, so, I mean, the rate at which the tags are found again is like 1,001. So, you know, it's hard when you do it with kids because they really expect that their tag is going to be found.
Mm-hmm.
But it hardly ever is. Are there any other questions about the migration?
Well, so if as we go through weather changes, assuming that we're going to see weather changes over here, as we noticed here in Western Washington, we had more rain, more wind this winter. So then we're going to be able to see a change in the migration of the monarch as the temperature. One of the problems that we have in Western Washington with bees is the bees are the same thing. They don't like to fly below 45 degrees.
Right.
So the beekeepers have a tough time developing strains that will fly in our early spring. And in fact, my son-in-law is a farmer, and the bees just sat in the hives when they really wanted some pollination going because the temperature was about 44 degrees or 43 degrees. So is that... So, as that migration comes down, if we have climate change, then the monarch's going to have to find some other way to go to find the warmer weather.
Well, and that, yes. So, that is one. So, thinking about the spring migration, we're talking about one of the really, really important things is the spring conditions in that southern part. And that would be a concern that it would be too hot or too cold. And then the same thing would be said about the fall migration. That if you did get a cold spot in Texas or anywhere in that southern U.S. before they move through, you wouldn't see a problem. But I do think that 40 extended periods where it was below 50, even during the day, is not very likely. When I've been in Texas in October, it's 80, 85 still. So the idea that it would be that cold 24 hours a day for that long, I think, we have really a lot of more problems than that.
Sure.
Yeah. But and in terms of Washington, if you remember the map of the west of the Rockies, they only get up into eastern Washington. That's really the far northern end of the range. So they're not going to get up there until middle of the summer.
Yeah.
You know, June, late June.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to the mountainous part, they're going...
I very rarely ever see a monarch where I live.
Yeah.
In western Washington, by the San Juan Islands.
Yeah.
Up in there, it's just too cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even in the summertime.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, though, in Southern California, now I know why there were so many butterflies in the summer.
Yeah.
We used to run around with the butterfly nets.
Yeah.
And
how did they survive really severe weather? I mean, I just am thinking about our drive across the country from Connecticut. I mean, we saw unbelievable weather. And I think we all know that storms are becoming more severe. And what on earth did they do? I could hardly walk to my car.
I would assume during the summer they're going to do the same thing. They're going to root and hope for the best. There's not a whole lot they can do. Caterpillars when you're looking at milkweeds and caterpillars, they're generally on the underside of the leaf, which would provide some protection. When it's extremely hot, so they will go down and kind of burrow in the top layer of the soil to get cool. So that's kind of a flip side of severe weather and extreme heat. In the overwintering sites, in 2002 and 2004, there were huge storms, and there was ice and snow where the monarchs were, which in large part was just a freak storm, but also it affected them so much more because they had been lost and it had been thinned, so all that hail and freezing rain and snow could get down into the trees where the butterflies were. And 80% of the monarchs died. And 80%, there was many dead monarchs in the overwintering site. And that is one of the predictions for that part of Mexico, is it's not going to get colder or warmer, which would be a concern, but the temperature is both the same and same, but the frequency of severe storms like that is both the same. And that's what, so what happened in 2002 and then again in 2004. But looking at the data of the summer population, it doesn't seem to matter. Mm-hmm. And again, that gets at the importance of the conditions in the southern U.S. in the spring. And monarchs are definitely limited by milkweed. They, female monarchs can lay way more eggs than they do. If you find a dead female butterfly in the summer, she will likely have fertilized eggs in her ovaries that she hasn't gotten a chance to lay, because they will only put one egg on each plant, because that's how much one caterpillar can eat in the whole plant. So if she puts more than one egg on there, that her offspring will be competing with each other. So they are definitely limited by milkweed, so we think that that's why even when 80% are killed in the overwintering site, we didn't really see an effect in the population in the summer, because that 20% was just that much better at laying eggs in the cell.
How many eggs
do they have? In captivity, so in the lab when we have them, we'll put them in little cages with milkweed, and there they will put more than one egg, and they'll put hundreds on a plant, because they don't have any other choice. And one female can lay 100 eggs in one day. But those ones, they're not flying, they're not looking for milkweed, they're just laying on one plant over and over again. But she'll lay 100 eggs a day. And I think the most we ever got from one female was 1,100 eggs.
Well,
so then you have to find 1,100 milkweed plants.
Well, that is.
That's a big cage.
Yeah.
So if one female has laid an egg on a milkweed plant, will another female lay an egg on a plant?
You do find multiple eggs on a plant. And we don't really understand if they can smell an egg and know not to lay there, or really.
There's chances.
Yeah, it might be chance, it might be, you know. But it's not too often that you find more than one on a plant. Mm-hmm. Most milkweed you look at doesn't have any eggs on it.
If there is more than one egg on a plant, will one starve? Or?
It depends. When they first hatch, they're really just eating their soul small. There are tiny ones in the back. Look at there, I mean, really, really small. You can barely see them. And they'll just eat around where their egg was. And they don't even need they could go a whole week on just one leaf. So in the beginning, it doesn't really matter. It's not until they're bigger, you know, they grow 2,000 times their original size before they turn into a butterfly. So it's not until those last 3 days before they make their chrysalis when they really need the bulk of their food. And by that time, they're really good at traveling. So if they're in kind of your typical milkweed patch in a prairie, they can find new plants.
Okay.
And then back to your question about severe weather, the caterpillar can get blown off plants, and they have to be able to find where their plant was and where a new plant. And we don't really know a whole lot about how they do that, but they do have, they can find new milkweed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great,
thanks, Reba.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.